From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump celebrated his acquittal in the Senate impeachment trial today with an hour-long, sometimes joyous and freewheeling, at others fact-free and vindictive, event in the East Room of the White House, praising Republicans who supported him, insulting Democrats and members of the FBI. Trump called his impeachment by the democratically controlled House of Representatives evil and corrupt, and said his administration went through hell unfairly.
It was leakers and liars, and this should never, ever happen to another president, ever. I don't know that other presidents would have been able to take it. Some people said no, they wouldn't have.
Yesterday, of course, the Republican-controlled Senate voted to acquit Trump on both counts that had been sent up by the House, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress charges. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, the only Republican to vote to convict the president, and only on the abuse of power charge. Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent for NPR, has been following all of this. Hi, Franco.
Hello.
And the day actually started at a prayer breakfast during which the president attacked Mitt Romney's religious faith, but then moved on to this event in the East Room of the White House, seeming to let loose on everything he's felt, although he doesn't hold back on Twitter. But this felt like it might have been almost a closed-door donor dinner at times. I mean, he used a curse word, BS. He called people sleazebags and do you almost get the sense that he forgot where he was, which was being broadcast, or do you think he absolutely knew?
I think he knew, and kind of like you're saying, I mean, he was releasing a lot of pent up tension that started at the prayer breakfast and continued in the East Room of the White House. And, you know, he thanked supporters and his legal team and his family, but he did not hold back on his political opponents, like, you know, as you noted. And he's calling Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, a horrible person, saying the similar things. Adam Schiff is evil. And he would go over that and over again.
I believe Adam Schiff was a sleazebag. I think to be, you know, he was evil and a sleazebag are some of the words that we've been hearing. Also, as you said, congratulating or thanking the many Republicans who supported him. Those people were probably breathing a sigh of relief, Devin Nunes and others, Mike Lee of Utah, because to them, this is going to mean something.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is something that they have been, you know, they put in a lot of their own political capital into this, particularly Devin Nunes. And he got kind of a standing ovation for it and for his thanks. I mean, President Trump really leaned on these guys. And as President Trump would say, they really delivered for him. President Trump repeatedly called them warriors. If you ask Democrats, however, they will say these members of Congress were part of the obstruction, part of the quote cover up that allowed President Trump to do what he did.
What do you make of how far the president still feels the need to reach back, saying that his good economy, you know, had nothing to do with President Obama? In this speech, which was supposed to be about his acquittal, he talked about how when he was first elected, the stocks were up and they would have crashed if he hadn't been elected. And of course, economists say that the economy has been growing since the Obama administration. Talking about James Comey, the Russia investigation. And yet, you know, some would say, why can't he let go of these? But it seemed to energize him over the course of the hour.
It is. He has a long memory, especially when he feels like there are people that have done them wrong. He often uses those examples, including talking about the economy and how well the economy is doing, to make his point that this is all a political investigation. It's all driven by people who are just dissatisfied and can't believe that he is president. Because if they would support him, there's no reason for them not to support a great economy. That is his consideration. But obviously, the Democrats see it differently.
Nancy Pelosi also spoke today. Speaker of the House had a press conference, tried to get into today's narrative, talked about the Obama administration having economic successes that President Trump, she said, still hasn't matched President Obama's growth in the stock market. So there's a lot of, you know, back and forth on these things. But does it feel to you as if between the State of the Union speech and today, in about the 30 seconds we have, the president really, he's trying to hammer down this narrative, and it feels like right now he has it.
You know, he is definitely hammering it down, and he definitely has it. I mean, he is making his case. And if you are a supporter of President Trump, you are, you know, in your, you are cheering, you are celebrating. And if you are a Democrat or a supporter of the House investigation, you're probably feeling that he is simply gloating and just kind of digging in your heels there. It's been, you know, this has become such a political football.
A remarkable time. NPR's Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Venezuela, where people are reacting to President Trump's meeting this week with opposition leader Juan Guaido. The meeting with Trump has been a long-sought goal of Guaido's. He's trying to drum up international support for his claim as Venezuela's rightful president. At President Trump's State of the Union address, Guaido was a guest of Trump's, and at least there, he seemed to get that recognition.
Here this evening is a very brave man who carries with him the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of all Venezuelans. Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President.
It was one of the rare bipartisan moments of the night. You can hear both Republicans and Democrats cheering. With us to talk about how all of this is being received in Venezuela is Emiliana Duarte. She's a freelance journalist in Caracas. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya. Thank you for having me.
And Emiliana, we had you on the show back in October. You were describing in great detail the impacts of inflation there, how a box of Cheerios costs about $15, and how at the time Guaido's support was waning because people were growing frustrated that he wasn't able to oust the current leftist president, Nicolas Maduro. Fast forward to this week. How are people reacting to Guaido's visit with President Trump?
Well, Guaido's meeting with Trump came at the end of a very high-profile tour that had him going to Europe and finally Washington, D.C. So there was a lot of expectation and speculation about whether or not this meeting at the White House was going to happen. So I think it definitely emboldened the opposition that had been growing frustrated and fatigued after a year of not being able to see results. And also definitely is a morale boost for Guaido at a moment when he really needed it after having been shut out of the National Assembly by the Maduro government ever since the beginning of this year.
But you've also expressed doubts that anything will actually come from Guaido's visit here other than optics for both politicians. Guaido, as we know, is looking for legitimacy wherever he can get it. And Trump is looking for political points, especially in South Florida, where there is a big Venezuelan community there. Guaido was actually in Miami holding a rally there. Some 3,000 people just a few days ago were in attendance. But with all of that said, I'm just wondering from you, what do you think is at the top of Guaido's wish list?
Well, regime change has been his main goal ever since he became interim president last year. But there is also the need for the U.S. and other countries to continue to help with the Venezuelan humanitarian crisis, as well as the refugee crisis in other countries.
I want to ask you about that, because the last time we spoke, grocery store shelves were largely empty, and so many Venezuelans were fleeing. There was just actually an article in the New York Times recently saying that Venezuela's capital is actually booming now. Can you tell us what you're seeing?
Yes. After years of empty supermarket shelves, at the end of last year, supermarket shelves once again were full of products. And this is attributed to a liberalization or a relaxing of strict controls that Maduro held over the economy for the past two decades.
To that point, though, about Maduro's hold, I mean, we're saying that this is all thanks to him liberalizing the economy somewhat. Do you think that it makes it harder for Guaido to make his case that Maduro must go?
I believe that it will certainly serve to demobilize people. Ever since Guaido started his journey to oust him last year, we would see rallies of hundreds of thousands of people in the capital whenever he would hold political meetings. And it just seems harder now that at least the capital of Venezuela is awash in dollars, and there's so much economic activity or at least an impression of economic activity or prosperity once again happening, I find it difficult to see how he can get those numbers of people out on the street protesting once again.
Yeah. You know, Emiliana, this is a theoretical question, but if Trump were to put military assistance on the table, how do you think Venezuelans would feel about that?
I think the Venezuelan opposition is just desperate. I mean, it has to be said that every single institutional channel for the past 10 years has been exhausted, and there's really no access to democracy or regime change through elections. So at this point, the prospect of a military intervention, I think, is more symbolic of how people have lost hope in the possibility of an internal solution to the Venezuelan political conflict.
That's Emiliana Duarte. She's a freelance journalist in Caracas who's been following the political situation closely. Emiliana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
It's Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Listen now, and we might even help you dominate your Oscars pool.
The trial against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein in New York continues this week. Weinstein is charged with several counts of rape and sexual assault. Yesterday, a sixth woman testified against Weinstein, and her testimony is expected to be the last before the district attorney's office rests its case. James Quigley has been covering this for the LA Times, and he joins us now. And a warning, this conversation may be difficult for some listeners as it includes details of sexual assault. James, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, James, you were at Monday's trial, and you've been covering this hearing since day one. What's the latest there?
So the last two major developments, Monday was a big day. Jessica Mann, who was the only accuser whose allegations resulted in criminal charges in New York, whose story hadn't been told publicly. It was her second day on the stand, and it was kind of a very sad scene in court. She became overwhelmed on cross-examination, broke down crying, and ultimately was not able to continue. They had to end court for the day. She's actually now off the stand as of Wednesday, but it was 3 days of her testifying, two of them spent on cross-examination, which was obviously very difficult for her to deal with the defense kind of attacking her story. Wednesday, Lauren Young, who was the last accuser to testify and a woman whose accusations have led to criminal charges against Weinstein in Los Angeles, is now testifying.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Jessica Mann's relationship with Weinstein?
Sure. So Jessica has alleged that Weinstein sexually assaulted her twice, but that was in the context of what she described as a consensual relationship. She met him in Los Angeles in either late 2012 or early 2013. The timeline is a little murky. When she was an aspiring actress, you know, she grew up doing theater in the Pacific Northwest, had been kind of struggling to make it, moved to LA. She meets Weinstein and he starts to talk to her about possible roles, specifically mentions there's a vampire film that she might be perfect for. So they meet, they have a couple of hotel meetings, and the story kind of starts to mirror some of these other allegations against Weinstein, that he met her under the pretense of business, and then the issue turned to something more sexual. He asked for a massage, which she did not want, and then there was a second meeting where she thought having a friend in the room would kind of prevent the situation from turning into a more personal lurid one. It did not. She accused him of forcing himself on her in some manner during that meeting. But as she testified, despite the fact that she was not, in her own words, sexually attracted to him, she did feel some kind of compassion for him and decided to continue to have some consensual sexual encounters with him. This boils over in New York in 2013 when she is in town trying to arrange a business meeting between Weinstein and a friend of hers who's working as an agent in Hollywood. They were supposed to have a breakfast meeting. Weinstein arrives at the hotel early and books himself into a room. Jessica, by her own testimony, believed that he was trying to engage a sexual encounter, which she did not want. They get into an argument. They wind up in the hotel room, and that is when she accuses him of a violent sexual assault, which resulted in the criminal charges in New York. The defense has continued to try to undercut this story by bringing up emails that went on for years after this between them that seemed to indicate a loving relationship. He did help her get a job at a hair salon later back in LA. So the defense is obviously arguing that, you know, this assault did not happen the way she described it in court.
Right, right. You've written about the parallels of this trial and that of comedian Bill Cosby. Can you say more?
Right. So there are a few through lines that mirror the two cases. One of the issues that prosecutors had to overcome in Cosby and will have to overcome here, the time element, I believe, in the Cosby case, he was tried in 2018 for an assault that was described to have happened in the early 2000s. Here, you have some assaults described more than 25 years prior to the date that this trial began. So they're trying to overcome the, a lot of issues as to, at least what the defense is saying, why did these women not report earlier? Why didn't they tell anybody in some cases? Why did they wait to come forward till now? Obviously, the Me Too movement is brought up often in court, and the defense has hinted in at least pre-trial interviews that they want to go after the idea that these women only came forward because they were swept up in the movement. At the same time, they've also got to overcome the defendant's physical appearance. In the Cosby trial, the comedian went on to make a claim that he had lost his eyesight not long before, I believe, jury selection began there. Here, Weinstein had a spinal decompression surgery in December, which is about a month before jury selection, which has left him needing a walker. In days in court when he has not appeared with a walker, he has appeared that he could not physically stand up on his own two feet. I saw him being helped, more or less dragged by one of his either attorneys or helpers into court on the day of opening statements. And in both cases, you had multiple what are called prior bad acts witnesses, women coming in to testify about other instances of possible sexual assault, misconduct, harassment involving Weinstein that were, either happened in a different jurisdiction or happened too long ago to be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. But it obviously helps the prosecution try to establish a pattern of what this, person's modus operandi would be as a sexual predator.
Yeah. And speaking of those witnesses and what their testimony brings, Sopranos actress Annabella Sciorra did confront Weinstein from the witness stand, testifying that the movie mogul raped and sexually assaulted her back in the mid-1990s. There seems to be a lot of evidence, but you kind of alluded to this just now. Those women also had relationships with Weinstein, so it's not necessarily a cut-and-dry case of rape as society knows that definition to be. Do you feel that in any way this is a hindrance to the prosecution?
I mean, it's certainly another obstacle they have to overcome because, like you said, the general public perception of sexual assault, and this has been brought up on the stand, is a stranger in an alleyway or, a violent assault from somebody you don't know. And that's not necessarily true. Much like, homicides, it's quite often that a assailant and a victim will know each other in a manner of, in a case of sexual assault. And that's the case in almost, at least in this case, rather, at least in the six women who have taken the stand, that's the case for most of them, that the women knew Weinstein either through Hollywood circles or stayed in touch with him after because they worked in the industry. Annabella knew him through Hollywood leading up to the date of the assault. Her case is a little different from the other two charge cases here because while they do have interactions afterward, there is not evidence of continued cordial emails or her putting up a friendly front as there might be in the case of some of these other women. She mostly describes him as harassing, stalking, and otherwise driving her up a wall after the date of the alleged assault. So her case is a little bit more narrowly defined, at least in what the public would think of as the relationship between a alleged sexual assault victim and an alleged assailant in one of those cases. But the other ones, yeah, you're right. Mimi Hallay and Jessica Mann, they kept up contact with him long after the dates of the alleged assaults. And, it kind of comes down to the defense and the prosecution having to make their best case to the jury as to why that was.
That's James Quealy with the LA Times. James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Hollywood lost a legend yesterday. Actor Kirk Douglas died at the age of 103. Over the course of six decades, Douglas appeared in some 80 films. He was known for his intense performances in films such as Lust for Life and Spartacus. One of his most acclaimed was in the 1957 film Paths of Glory. Douglas played a colonel who attempts to prevent the court-martial and execution of three innocent soldiers, only to be thwarted by his superiors.
Gentlemen of the court, there are times when I'm ashamed to be a member of the human race, and this is one such occasion. It's impossible for me to summarize the case for the defense since the court never allowed me a reasonable opportunity to present my case.
Are you protesting the
order? In November of 2018, Kirk Douglas's son, actor-producer Michael Douglas, spoke with Jeremy Hobson. Douglas is a two-time Oscar winner, once in 1988 for his performance in Wall Street. But as he told Jeremy, he owed his father for his first Oscar, which Michael Douglas won for producing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
It was solely by chance. I was fortunate that my father had owned the rights to the book, had it adapted into a play. And then afterwards, he had tried for a few years to get it made into a movie. He couldn't. I had started my career after college, was working, was sliding into episodic television. And I heard that Dad was selling the project. I said, look, let me try to run with this, and I'll get it set up for you to play the part. Mm-hmm. And I tried for a few years, finally got it set up, and by that point, time had gone by. My father was a little older. Of course, he's never forgiven me for this. And I understand it. This is one of the great parts in your life. But it was the passion for that project. I loved that story and had the opportunity.
Was there an intimidation factor for you in following in your father's footsteps?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I had no interest in acting, you know. It was the 60s. I was in Santa Barbara, California. I was a hippie, you know, University of California, Santa Barbara. Finally, I think it was my third year, they called me to the chancellor's office. I was a junior, and they said, you know, you have to declare a major. I said, huh? Yeah, you got to declare. You can't keep taking general education courses. You got to declare a major. I said, I don't know, man. Maybe theater arts. I figured my mother was an actress and my dad, but I had no interest, so I came to it reluctantly. And I wasn't very good. Dad was the first one he came up to see those first shows. You know, you were terrible.
Really?
Yes. Well, I mean, he rightfully so. I mean, our union runs at about 90% unemployment, and I think he was very worried after what he saw. And so I was a grinder, and I just kept at it. But yes, of course, anybody else, a father and son business, but in ours, someone would say, that's just like your father, and you're trying to create your own identity. So for me, that year of it was a kind of a combination of Fatal Attraction, followed coming out 2 months later with Wall Street, and winning the Oscar was a big moment for me, because I really felt it was the first time I was outside the shadow of an extraordinary career, an extraordinary man.
Actor-producer Michael Douglas speaking about his father, Kirk Douglas, who died yesterday at the age of 103.
And with nearly all of the Iowa caucus results in after a three-day delay, Pete Buttigieg's lead over Bernie Sanders has shrunk a bit to a statistical tie, 26.2 to 26.1%, a race the AP considers too close to call. And now Tom Perez, chair of the Democratic National Committee, who's been quiet about the debacle brought on by a new app, is calling for a re-canvass. Isaac Stanley Becker is covering the story for The Washington Post. And Isaac, we know this was a caucus, volunteers counting voters willing to stand for a candidate in a corner. And then they turn that number in. So what is a re-canvass? Does everyone have to go back to their corners? Is it different from a recount? What is it?
No, that would be really something if everyone had to return to these sites. A re-canvass is a process where there's a hand audit of the math worksheets and the reporting forms that come out of each of those roughly 1,700 precincts across the state. It's not quite so arduous as a full recount, which would involve a hand count of each of the what's called presidential preference cards that each of the caucus goers at each of those sites fills out. So it's taking a kind of aggregate figure completed at the site and checking each of those to make sure that it's authentic and correct, not actually going back to the individual preferences of each caucus goer.
Well, why do it? Because, yes, there's huge frustration over the slow return, and the candidates, many of them didn't feel they got the wind in their sails that they needed to send them into New Hampshire. But nobody, I don't think, has said that they don't like the results. They don't believe the results. They're slow, but nobody's claimed that they're inaccurate. Even Joe Biden, who didn't do as well as he expected, accepted the results, said it was a gut punch. So why is this being called for? Because it would seem it would further slow the momentum of the Democrats going into New Hampshire.
Well, what I'm hearing from Democratic officials is that there's really a need to restore public confidence. So even though the state party has said that it has access to the underlying paper trail and the results, and that they're certain of the integrity of those results, there are just so many lingering questions still 3 days after caucus night about the math, about possible rounding mistakes, about technological failures that delayed the results so much, about who exactly was victorious and by what sort of metric. So the desire from Perez is really to say, let's pause, let's make sure we're accurate, and let's make sure the public trusts the process.
Well, but do you anticipate any Democratic campaign pausing? I mean, they want to have as much acceleration in this moment as possible.
That's right. And they're already in their third day now of campaigning in New Hampshire, which holds its presidential primary on Tuesday. So they're looking ahead. But still, there is some question about who actually is able to claim victory in Iowa, and the sort of wind that puts in the sails of which candidate it is significant.
And so what might happen in the few seconds we have? How might it look if this happens? Because by the rules, this request had to go in, I think, by tomorrow. So what happens?
Right, and a campaign actually needs to put in a request. The point also is that, you know, no matter what happens, the same number of delegates is likely to be awarded to the two top candidates here. So in terms of support at the summer convention in Milwaukee, it's unlikely to make a difference there. But the optics are important, and certainly getting the process and the math right is important.
Okay, so we'll follow this story, see what they actually do in Iowa after this request from Tom Perez, a chair of the Democratic National Committee, to have a re-canvass. Isaac Stanley Becker of the Washington Post, thank you.
Thank you.
Twenty American firefighters who normally work with the Angeles National Forest are back in California today after volunteering to fight the devastating Australian wildfires, which took the lives of three other American firefighters when their plane crashed. The worst of the fires have abated, but the fire season in Australia is hardly over. Fires raging this week near Canberra, where temperatures soared over 104 degrees. The Australian fires killed more than 30 people and an estimated billion animals. And there are concerns over air quality, not just now, but in the long term, which scientists say are global concerns. Things like thunderstorms act like chimneys launching particles into the atmosphere, where they may hitch a ride on the jet stream. Atmospheric scientist Neil Leroux is with the University of Nevada. He joins us now. Professor Leroux, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And just your sense of what you've been seeing in the fires. You've seen a lot of fires, and we understand that there's been enough carbon dioxide in the smoke coming from the fires in Australia to rival that country's total human-caused emissions. How would you characterize how big this is?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And it's really the scope, the size and extent of these fires, in addition to the severity, that is quite remarkable. Obviously, Australia is no stranger to intense and devastating wildfires, but really the scope this year, and like you said, essentially equaling the annual emissions, anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide at this point.
Yeah. Well, and before we go into the long-term impacts, which we want to hear about, talk about what goes into the air right away.
So there's this kind of immediate impact, which tends to come from these very small particulates contained within the smoke. Diameter is less than 2.5 microns, or PM2.5 for short. And this is particularly hazardous because it eludes most of your natural filtration mechanisms. It can get deep in your lungs and, in fact, diffuse into your bloodstream, where it can then have certain cardiovascular impacts. So in addition to just the difficulty breathing, we can see some of these other kind of deleterious health impacts over time.
Well, and of course, there's the fact that, you know, this smoke and ash sometimes goes up in the air and then particles and ash come back down.
Yeah. In addition to the particulates that you're breathing, these plumes are lofting burning particles of ash and what we call firebrands, which can then land in advance to the fire front and rapidly spread the fire through the landscape. And really one of the more hazardous ways that these fires spread.
Well, and when it comes again to just sheer breathing, you're seeing cardiovascular problems. And researchers also saw decreased birth weights in California?
Yeah, that's right. We've had a number of studies done after some of the high-impact fires in Southern California in particular that show a host of negative health outcomes, and one of them is decreased birth weights. So certainly, you know, anytime you have people in vulnerable segments of the population, whether it's due to underlying health issues or certainly in the case of pregnancies, we then see things like decreased birth weights following these large-scale events affecting highly populated regions.
Yeah, just terrible. But let's talk now about the global impact. And here's where we have to go back to, what, fourth grade? And the difference between the atmosphere and the stratosphere. Talk about these long-term effects and this plume of smoke that, you know, creates thunderstorms.
Yeah, exactly. So we have two parts of the atmosphere that we're concerned about, the troposphere, which is close to the surface, and this is where all of the weather is occurring. And then the overlying layer is called the stratosphere. And what we see with these intense fires is that they generate their own thunderstorms, which effectively double the height to which the smoke will be injected into the atmosphere and can push it deep enough that it ascends all the way up into that stratospheric layer. And once it's there, it can stay there for a prolonged period of time, sometimes 5, 6, maybe even a year-long period, 5 or 6 months, that is, or up to a year even, where we can track these plumes of smoke aerosol circling the globe. In fact, we know already that the smoke has fully encircled the southern hemisphere, going back to some of the events that started in December and are continuing now. And so this is stuff that's going to stay there for a long time because there's no mechanism to remove it from the atmosphere once it gets that deep.
Well, okay. What do you say to people who say, good, get it up out of our atmosphere, get it up in the stratosphere? You know, what's the problem with it up there?
Well, it may not be something that we're immediately breathing. What it is doing is interacting with sunlight coming in to the Earth's climate system. And in this case, it's actually absorbing some of the sun's energy higher up in the atmosphere in the stratosphere and warming the stratosphere a little bit. It's also decreasing the amount of sunlight that's reaching Earth's surface. And so there's this kind of complex interaction that could have kind of climate scale impacts and certainly regional impacts on the temperature of Earth, the temperature of the upper atmosphere. And some of these impacts are not fully understood at this point, especially since we don't have a lot of documentation for events of this magnitude. There's really just a few of these increasing understanding of the impact that they're having, but a whole lot of work still to be done.
Right. Well, David Moore at the National Center for Earth Observation said he believes that these, you know, clouds of smoke, while they're up in the stratosphere, can then hop on the jet stream and just use it to commute, you know, around the world. What's the bigger concern? I mean, we talked about the particles. Are the particles going as well? So when these warm winds hit places far from Australia, will they contain those particles? Or is it solely the carbon dioxide, which is in this smoke, which we know contributes to warming?
Yeah, it's kind of a mix. And again, there are a number of potentially competing influences here. The carbon dioxide is a gas that's emitted into the atmosphere and can remain in the troposphere and can remain relatively well mixed and contributes, generally speaking, to the greenhouse effect, although it's quite complicated by how much of that is going to be reabsorbed by the growth of new vegetation following these fires. And that's kind of different than the particulate matter, these aerosol particles that are getting injected very deep into the atmosphere and can have these kind of radiative effects where it's intercepting sunlight. And some of those signals are actually kind of competing. In the one sense, carbon dioxide can be warming the lower part of the atmosphere. On the other hand, some of these smoke particles are intercepting sunlight and can either warm the upper atmosphere or potentially cool the lower atmosphere. So again, there's a kind of complex chain of interactions that we're still working to tease out how all of that is going to balance out over time.
Well, you mentioned how high the smoke is at this point, you know, 30,000 feet above 40,000 feet. So you're not going to be breathing that in, but is there a chance that a year and a half from now, and again, this is a chance, you know, a speculation, that smoke might, you know, be on a jet stream that comes down the Atlantic or something, and people find themselves breathing smoke from a fire the year previous in Australia?
Probably not in any appreciable concentration that would be problematic from a kind of human health standpoint. Most of this stuff is traceable in the deep upper atmosphere for, you know, 5 to 6 months, and after that it becomes so diffuse that it would be difficult to really identify it beyond that point. So, but again, it's not fully understood at this point.
Well, and what about people who can get up there? You know, flights, you know, personality, the profile of these clouds up there. Are they thunderstorms up there? And Does that make flight dangerous?
Yeah, so this is a great question. Flying through these clouds and these deep plumes as they're ascending on their way to the stratosphere could be potentially very hazardous for aircraft. We saw there was a Qantas Airlines flight that had encountered severe turbulence as it flew through one of these developing clouds and had to make an emergency landing. And we know from some of the research that we've done here in the United States, looking inside these clouds with radars, that they can have updraft speeds upwards of 130 miles per hour, flanked by downdrafts as strong as 60 miles per hour. So you can imagine the kind of whiplash effect that would have on an aircraft flying through something like that. And it's really as strong as the updrafts in Earth's strongest thunderstorms, and certainly not somewhere you would want to be flying an aircraft.
No. Your thoughts about the people in Australia, not all of Australia, but even if you watched tennis recently, you saw the temperature at, 100. That was in Melbourne, not where the fires are. But, then we see these images of how people have been, trying to maintain some health through this. I mean, your thoughts as you watch this.
Yeah. And, we've seen it here in the Western United States as
sure.
Well. It has both that immediate health impact and terms of breathing this stuff, but also a psychological impact in terms of being in these smoke palls for day after day after day. It feels quite oppressive. I know back in the summer of 2018 here in California and then the following fall with some of the very big fires that we had, everybody was feeling that effect. And my colleagues in Australia have communicated this. It's really quite significant, the psychological impact in addition to the health impact.
Yeah. That's atmospheric scientist, the professor Neil LaRoe from the University of Nevada, from the studios of KUNR. Neil, thanks so much for, the science lesson for us. Thank you.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks for reaching out. Real honor and pleasure to speak with you.
Scientists are still a long way off in finding a cure for cancer, but researchers in the UK have recently made a significant step toward the creation of a universal treatment for cancer. Researchers at Cardiff University School of Medicine in Wales say they've discovered a new method for killing a wide range of cancers by utilizing T-cell receptors within the immune system. To explain the science behind this, we're joined by Michael Crowther via Skype. He's one of the researchers, and he's in Denmark. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yes, so we know you're in the early stages of this testing, but it sounds like a pretty significant development.
We're very excited by this research, yeah.
So the focus is on trying to find immune cells that are reactive to bacteria. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so when I first started the project, the goal was to try and find, as you say, T cells that could react to multiple different bacteria. We do know that these already exist. We were just trying to find new versions of these that would recognize bacteria in multiple different people. And while I was doing that, I basically had these cancer cells that we used to activate the T cells. But what we normally do is load bacteria onto these cancer cells. It's actually the bacteria products that then activate the T cells usually. But I also had in my experimental setup a cancer cell line that didn't have any bacteria, just as like a control, just so we can work out if it is actually the bacteria that are activating these immune cells. What I found was actually it was the ones that didn't have any bacteria that were activating some immune cells the best. So what I did next was I screened it against a couple of different cancers. Then it recognized all the cancers that we tested it against in the beginning.
Wow, so we're talking prostate, breast, lung, and some other cancers.
Yeah, cervical, blood, skin, breast, which was particularly interesting because all of these cancer types, cancer is basically a collection of diseases. So it's not one disease, it's all different types. And this immune cell that I found didn't seem to matter.
So as I understand this method, it's not been tested on humans, only on mice and on different cancer cells from actual patients. Can you explain briefly the testing process for that?
Yeah, so with the mouse model, what we did is, so we take a cancer cell, and then it's actually a human cancer cell line. We put that into the mouse, and then we let that attach itself inside the mouse. When that has happened, we can then put the immune cells into the mouse. And what that did is basically it cleared away the cancer from the mouse. extended survival of these mice by weeks. Weeks is actually a very long time.
How would this practice work on actual cancer patients, on humans?
Well, it's very early to talk about actually taking it into patients yet, but because with patients who are very sick, we can actually hopefully get an advanced timeline on taking these immune cells into patients. And it would probably work similar to CAR T cells, which is basically when you take a patient's own immune cells and then you put in the receptor from these T cells, you can then put those immune cells back into a patient and then hopefully clear their own cancer. So that's how it's normally done. Hopefully we will just be able to have like a bank of immune cells and then we can just directly just give that to the patient without having to expand their own immune cells. And we can basically shorten the timeline for treating these patients.
As I mentioned, this raises the prospect of a universal treatment for cancer, kind of a one-size-fits-all cancer treatment. You know, I know there are thousands of researchers out there who have been studying for so long to find a treatment that works in all people. What does it boil down to and why it has potentially taken so long?
So when you're looking at the T cells, they usually recognize a subset of proteins called HLA. And the trouble with HLA is it's actually everyone has a different set of HLA. So when their immune cells are given to another person, they don't react to these cancer cells because they will have a different HLA. And this HLA is extremely important for T cells in order to recognize the whatever they recognize on the cancer. So that's why finding these universal targets, especially for T cells, has been so difficult. So that's what's exciting about this research is that this MR1 protein is the same. So then that means that we don't have this HLA problem.
What's next for the research? I know that you said it's going to be quite a while before this is tested on actual cancer patients.
Yeah. So first, what we want to do is ensure that it's actually safe. We've already shown an example of one in the study that we published, but we want to actually take more immune cells from patients and then put in this new receptor and then make sure that it's still safe in the lab with their own healthy cells and their own cancer cells and make sure it kills only the cancer cells. Another arm of the research that we want to find is specifically what it is about these cancers that is enabling them to be recognized by this immune cell. So that'll be quite important just to make sure that there's no other side effects. Once we know exactly what that molecule and that process that leads to this immune activation, that is really what we need to find out.
That's Michael Crowther, one of the researchers of a study from Cardiff University's School of Medicine's on a new discovery of a universal cancer therapy. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.